Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. John Henry Holliday should have led the life of a cultivated, prosperous professional man, but tuberculosis changed all of that. He was born in Georgia and headed west at the tender age of 22 in search of a healthier climate and ended up becoming a legendary gambler and gunfighter. Our guest for this hour, novelist Mary Doria Russell, says that the real John Henry Holliday was sick, he was lonely, and often scared. In her words, he was a motherless child in far exile, doing the best that he could to stay alive in a very dangerous place. That is the person that she writes about in her new novel that we'll be talking about this morning. The title of the book is Doc. It's published by Random House. It's just out, and she's just at the beginning of her touring around the country talking about the book, and we're very pleased that she could be spending some time with us here on the telephone to talk about it. She's an award-winning writer. Her four previous bestsellers, The Sparrow, Children of God, The Thread of Grace, and Dreamers of the Day. She, by her academic training, is an anthropologist. She has a doctorate in biological anthropology. She taught gross anatomy at Case Western Reserve University School of Dentistry before going on to become a writer. She is also a graduate of the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and we're pleased to have her with us. Questions, comments, welcome. You can join us by giving us a call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send us an email, you may do that too. And the address is will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk, just as it sounds, at illinois.edu. And Ms. Russell, hello.
Hi.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
I'm delighted to be with you.
Well, you know, when the book came in, I saw it and I recognized your name from having read your first two books, Sparrow and Children of God, which are science fiction novels. And I know that you've written it in some other genres as well. So when I saw it, I thought, well, this would be interesting because I've read this writer. And then when I saw what it was about, I thought, aha, a Western. Well, that's really interesting. And I thought I'd like to see what you would do with that. And I found it, you know, very entertaining. I certainly enjoyed reading the book.
I'm glad to hear it.
What made you want to write a Western?
Well, you know, it's getting to be almost a game with me. What genre have I not done? The first two were classical science fiction. Second two were 20th century historicals, one about the 1921 peace conference, which defined the modern Middle East, and then Thread of Grace was about Jewish survival in Nazi-occupied Italy. That was a thriller, and I thought, well, I haven't done I should do a mystery. That's what I actually started out with. The idea was, I should do a mystery now. And honestly, the first glimmer of what became Doc was the fact that I thought, what if there was a murder? And Doc Holliday figured it out from the dental records because he was a dentist and he would recognize the teeth. And that becomes a tiny seed for what became a much different book about him. There is a murder mystery involved, but it's really about Doc Holliday.
Yeah. And I think that's interesting because with as much that has been written about these characters, the Earp brothers in particular, the stories always seem to revolve around them and around Wyatt particularly.
Yeah, and about the Tombstone about the gunfight.
That's exactly right. And about the time that they were in Tombstone and the gunfight at the OK Corral. So this takes place, not only does this take place earlier than that, but here the Doc Holliday, who in a lot of these other stories is a supporting character, maybe a strong supporting character, but a supporting character. Now he comes to the center of the story.
Yes. And Wyatt's brother Morgan.
Yes.
Morgan often becomes just a plot device. He gets killed in Tombstone, and that sets up the Earp vendetta when Doc and Wyatt ride off and, in all truth, hunt down his killers and execute them extrajudicially. So Morgan hardly, you know, he's just kind of an affable guy on the edges of the story. And the more that I read about these guys, I started out with Doc and with his real life. And I thought, you know, no, it doesn't make sense that the friendship is between him and Wyatt. They had almost nothing in common. But Morgan was a reader, and Doc was well-educated, and to find somebody else who cared about books was very important to him. Morgan was also just just a nice guy. It was impossible to dislike him. He was a very sweet guy. And I think that the entire family revolved around him. He was the heart of that family. And after Morgan was killed, it pretty much fell to pieces. The brothers split up. Doc and Wyatt never saw one another again. And Morgan held everybody together. He was the center of that wheel.
And maybe I should just mention there that this book, your novel, this is set in the year is 1878, and this is set during the time when Doc and the Earps were living in Dodge City, Kansas.
Dodge City. That's that's where the friendship began. And in 1878, that's about 3-4 years before the gunfight and Morgan's assassination. This was the last summer that Dr. Holliday was able to, he felt well enough, and he was able to set up a dental practice. And in all of the movies, you know, Doc is, it's like he had this odd hobby involving other people's teeth. But he dumped his day job as soon as he got a chance to go west and be a gambler. And that is really not his story. He was a very dedicated healthcare professional, we would call them now. He felt very strongly about his profession. And you have to understand that in a world where, you know, 99% of the people had never seen a toothbrush, let alone used one, dental care was something that could save lives. And people died in misery because of abscesses and rotten teeth and infections that set in. And Doc could relieve that suffering, and it meant a great deal to him that he'd be able to do that. So in 1878, in Dodge City, he hung out his shingle and made his last serious attempt to support himself as a dentist.
He was a child of the Southern aristocracy. He grew up in Georgia. He had an uncle who was a physician, who was, I think, an important figure in his life.
Yes.
And so Doc, when he was starting to think about John Henry, when he started to think about what he would do with his life, was perhaps moved to be a physician like his uncle. And apparently his uncle said to him, "No, son, what you should do is you should go into dentistry." And because apparently at the time, dentistry was actually held in higher esteem.
Higher respect, and was far more scientific.
Huh.
Having worked at the Case Western Reserve School of Dentistry, I was in a position to be able to judge the rigor of the dental training that he took, and it was extraordinary. I mean, it's very, very modern. Modern dentists take all those same courses. They take additional ones now, but he was very well trained. And it was a credentialed profession, as opposed to, you know, a doctor who could, you know, slap a label on anything and say, "This will grow your hair and cure tuberculosis and make you swell in bed." You know, it was just, it was a joke by that time. And his uncle was ashamed of the way the medical profession had gone and urged him to go into dentistry instead.
So I'm sure that you ended up doing a lot of research on the period for writing the book, but based on your academic training, it sounds as if this whole business of the jaw and the teeth and the structure of the mouth would actually be something that you already did know.
I already knew about all of that, yeah. I didn't have to look up the path of that bullet that that hit a Texan in the face. I was able to do that from memory, yeah. And
our guest in this hour, Mary Doriot Russell. She's a novelist. Her newest is a Western murder mystery. The central character is Doc Holliday, and the title of the book is Doc, and it's published by Random House, and it is just out. And, of course, questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, very clearly, you found the character of this man, John Henry Holliday, very compelling.
Yeah.
Tell me what about him drew you.
Well, when I read the biography by a relative of his, Karen Holliday Tanner, wrote a biography called Doc Holliday, A Family Portrait. And that biography was the only one, is the only one still, that has taken advantage of family memoirs, family documents, and information that had never been made public before. Doc came from a Georgia family that, you know, they had 1,700 acres under cotton before the Civil War. They were slave owners. They took breeding quite seriously. And John Henry Holliday was born with a cleft palate, and that is a shock even today when we know that it can be fixed. At the time, it was a stunning and very disturbing event. His uncle, John Stiles Holliday, may, as far as I have been able to determine, is the first surgeon to correct a cleft palate. And he told his sister-in-law, Doc's mother, if you can keep him alive for a couple of months, I think that the defect may be repaired. And so here is this 22-year-old mother with, she had just buried her first child about a month before John Henry was born. So she's still in mourning. She has this child born with this shocking malformation, and she keeps him alive with an eyedropper, getting up every hour to feed that child for 8 long weeks. Now, if you've had a baby, you know what sleep deprivation is like. And that, she didn't trust anybody else with his life. It was just John Henry and Alice together round the clock for 8 weeks. She kept him alive. The defect was repaired. He was left with a significant speech defect. And she, all on her own, this 22-year-old girl, invented speech therapy. She gave him piano lessons. She homeschooled him. Here is this intensely close mother-child bond. And that's something that's never been taken into account in the stories that use John Henry Holliday, that use Doc Holliday as a character. So I wanted to write about Alice Holliday's boy. I wanted to write about her son and about this this intensely devoted child who watched his mother die when he was 15 years old. She died of tuberculosis.
And that is really, so here we have this intense bond between John Henry and his mother, and probably she was the most important person in his life.
Absolutely.
And here one can imagine just how devastating it would have been for him. He was a teenager, and she dies of tuberculosis.
Right, and I don't have to go far for in the way of imagination for that. My father, he and his mother were very close, and she died when he was the same age as John Henry Holliday. Now, he is in his mid-80s now, and to this day, he has nightmares that confuse his mother's long illness and death with World War II, which was the war that he grew up with. And in that dream, the enemy is coming and coming and coming, and he's firing and firing and firing. He's trying to protect his mother, and he runs out of bullets, and so he starts throwing rocks, and he runs out of rocks. And in the dream, the enemy always breaks through, and his mother always dies. And that is just so heartbreaking to me. And you never get over it. That's a terrible time for a boy to lose a mother.
Yeah.
And so there again, I had some direct experience. No, well, not direct, but I had close experience of what this young man's life was. That's the boy I'm following out to the rawest edge of the American frontier.
Yeah. And for John Henry, this also led to the estrangement with his father,
yes,
who marries, John Henry, I'm sure, thinks he marries inappropriately quickly, marries,
yes,
a much younger woman who's,
right,
not that much older than John Henry.
But
that was very...
And my father never forgave him for that.
Well,
the whole dynamic was there.
That's interesting. Well, and of course, at that time, that would not have been... There would have been nothing unusual about that. You know, people died, and then...
After the Civil War, as Margaret Mitchell describes in Gone with the Wind, you had an awful lot of women who had no other role than to be married, and an entire generation of young men had died. So this much younger woman married Henry Holliday 2 months after his first wife died.
Now, it's interesting you mentioned Margaret Mitchell, because there is a distant relation between the Holidays and the Mitchells, and that you drew to some extent on Margaret Mitchell's writing.
Yes, she they were cousins. I think twice removed. I think that's how you say it, because it's two generations later.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, she says that she had said that. She based her story, Gone with the Wind, on family stories that have been passed down. When you know John Henry Holliday's biography, you can read Gone with the Wind, and you can recognize who she's talking about. Oh, that's Cousin George. He was the one when the military school kids go out for a last-ditch protection of Atlanta at the end of the war. That's Doc's Cousin George. When Ashley walks home from the prisoner of war camp in the north, that's Doc's uncle, Uncle Robert. And when you think about Ashley and Melanie and Rhett, there are very strong echoes of John Henry Holliday's life. Melanie was the religious name of the cousin that he had a childhood romance with Martha Ann, and she did join the Sisters of Charity, and her religious name was Sister Mary Melanie. And Margaret Mitchell says that Melanie Wilkes is based on that woman. There's all kinds of echoes, particularly in the two characters of Ashley and Rhett Butler, who, if you're familiar with the story, Rhett was completely ostracized because he had become a professional gambler, as Doc Holliday had to become. And the only person who would speak to him was Melanie Wilkes. And I believe that that is an echo of the fact that Doc became a professional gambler, and the only one who refused to turn away from him was his cousin Martha Ann.
He was diagnosed with tuberculosis, and this was at a time when it was not understood. The
That's
disease
right.
was not well understood.
That they find out that it's a bacillus.
And they didn't know that it was an infectious disease.
That's
they didn't
right.
know how people got it.
That's
but
right.
they did have this idea that people would be better off in a different climate. So
yeah.
that's how it is that he ended up going from Atlanta to initially to Texas.
Yeah. And got there just as the economy crashed. There was a post-Civil War railroad boom, very much like what we've just been through with real estate. Enormous amounts of money being made very quickly, and a great deal of prosperity that was based on debt. A bank went under, a railroad failed, and everything came crashing down. And that happened just as he arrived in Texas with his, you know, hoping. He had a partnership with another dentist, and there simply wasn't enough money to go around, and he was laid off. Nobody had money for dental care at that point. And so there was no welfare. He had no relatives out there, and gambling was the only way he could make a living.
So then, how does he end up going from being in Texas to being in Kansas?
Well, one of the few places that did okay was Kansas was the railhead for Texas cattle drives, and. There were a string of cow towns along the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railway, and each one of them in turn became very prosperous. And in 1878, it was Dodge City that had come to the fore. And by that time, Doc had begun living with Kate Haroney, who was also an extraordinary person. And Kate was always pragmatic. She said, "Dodge is where the money is." And so they went to Dodge because Kate usually got her own way.
Yeah.
And that was a place where he continued to gamble. He had to buy equipment, he had to set up an office, and he needed to have something to live on while he was waiting to build a practice. But that was where he felt that he could really sink some roots and pick his life up again.
Yeah, and this would have been an extraordinarily wild place at least certain times of the year because the cowboys would come.
Yeah.
They'd come with the cows
to
ship them off.
You know, these are 17-year-old boys who have been, you know, working awful. Being on a cattle drive was not fun. But they'd get to Dodge, and they'd be paid in cash. And here are these kids. And, you know, their parents are long, you know, they're far away. There are no preachers to holler at them. They are free to do anything they can think of and pay for. And, boy, they do.
Yeah, and if one was...
Average age in Dodge... The oldest man in the town was 38, and the average age was like 19.
Yeah.
So it got wild.
Yeah, as if one was thinking of establishing a den of iniquity, this would have been a fine place.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no question. No question. But what I found interesting about Dodge was that in 1878, it was just on the cusp of big changes where the churchgoers, the families were moving in, the people who had legitimate businesses got tired of having to replace the glass windows on their stores when these kids would shoot the glass out. They didn't want their kids getting hurt. They wanted to have civilization come. And in 1878, that political knife edge was beginning to play itself out, and that's part of what my book is about.
Yeah,
I was actually serving on my city's planning and zoning commission at the same time I was writing Doc. And my job was to research gun control laws, ordinances, and vice laws around the country to see what legal basis we would have for regulating basically titty bars and gun shops. And I realized that I was looking at the exact same issues that the city council in Dodge City was looking at in 1878.
Well, and then there's this very interesting dynamic here that in the town there between the two sides of the street, between the respectable
yes.
side
and the wrong side of the tracks other... becomes that phrase. On the north side of the Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe, you had the legitimate businesses and the nicer saloons. On the south side of the tracks, the wrong side of the tracks, that's where you had the girls who worked in cribs. You had the major whorehouses and the saloons and the gambling joints and all the rest of it. So that's where we get the idea of zoned vice zones, combat zones, they call them in Boston, where it's okay as long as you keep it south of the tracks and you don't shoot up the other side of the town.
Yeah. So there's been so much written about these characters, and they have grown so much in the telling over time. And even interestingly enough, even the characters in the book make observations about distortions of fact.
Oh yeah, even at the time.
Even at the time.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
How do you, in the process of writing this, try to get back to something close to the truth?
Yes, close to the reality.
Yeah, close to the reality.
With
yeah.
all of my stories, with all five books, it's been very important for me to get a handle on the childhood of the characters. And that means I need to know about it's critical to know about their parents. It's often very helpful to know about their grandparents. So I go with historical characters, I go as deep as I can on them. And I did for both the Earps and for John Henry Holliday. Even with fictional characters, I have to have a clear idea of, if Renzo Leone is 30 in 1943, then how old was his mother when she had him? What history did she live through? You know, all of those things give me a depth of character that I can then rely on. Once I'm sure I have a bead on these people, then I can put them into the same situations that fiction has put them into. But I can react to them in a non-stereotyped way. Wyatt, for example, I believe he was dyslexic. He was not a reader. He found it difficult. Once spent an entire year trying desperately to read one law book and gave it up, could not do it. And so getting him back to that, finding out that his father was, I can't say this on radio, but a bad man.
He was abusive.
An abusive, violent, yeah. Terrifying old man. And that was a key to understanding the Earp brothers.
Yeah.
When you look at Wyatt, he's the middle child of eight. You know, usually middle children kind of get lost in the shuffle. So one of the big mysteries that I had to work out in my own mind was, what made him so compelling? Why was he had such presence. Everybody agrees that he could look at a man and make him take a step back. Mm-hmm. This is in a world where physical violence is quite common. Wyatt can just look at these guys, and they cave. So that was one of the things that I wanted to be able to understand and explain.
Well, I think you make a really interesting observation, which I think is absolutely true. It was somebody in the book, and I forget who it is, but essentially somebody in the book makes this observation that bullies are people who grew up to be bullies because they were
They were bullied. Yeah. And bullies are beaten boys.
Yes.
Wyatt says this. Bullies are beaten boys. A man who beats his sons is trying to make cowards, and most of the time it works. 99 times out of 100, he says it works. And Doc asks him, what about the 100th boy? And Wyatt says, we can go either way.
And he's talking about himself.
Yeah, kill the old man, which is to say become even worse.
Yeah.
Or become a better one, which is what Wyatt and his brothers tried to do.
And he says something about how when you face down a bully, what you're doing is, whether you're, in general, maybe you're doing it nonverbally, but what you're doing
it's
is
scorn.
You're reminding him of the person that told him he was a worthless piece of trash,
yes,
which
exactly,
likely was exactly. His father.
When you look at a bully,
yeah.
It's scorn.
Yeah.
It's not hatred, he says. With scorn, they are 9 years old, and they're just what their fathers wanted them to be, powerless and frightened. And so he's seen that, and you really do find that pattern where bullies tend to repeat. There was just a study, I think, of the Boston Globe that talks about most of the time bullies are people who are bullied at home. They have seen a lot of violence in their own home. They have experienced a lot of violence. And then you do get this minority, which become really ugly, or which they become protectors. They become cops quite frequently. They join the military, and they are the ones who are quite idealistic soldiers. So it is a pattern that shows up all.
Yeah, and Wyatt is someone who, at least through time now, has acquired the character, and people actually did talk about it as being extraordinarily fearless, but also incorruptible. And in the book, he says something when he's being hired to be the law there in Dodge. He says something like, look, I'm not going to make any exceptions. Somebody breaks the law, I'm hauling it in. It doesn't matter who they are, whose friend he is, whose son he is. He's going in. And he says to the person who hires him, and if you got a problem with that, well, I'm not taking this job.
Exactly. And that actually, we don't have a quote from Wyatt saying that, but we do have the reality, a kernel of truth that I then based my murder mystery on. When he was in Wichita, he had just begun as a part-time policeman, and there was a black man named Charles Sanders, who, this is post-war, early 70s, Wichita was the big cattle town at that time. And a couple of Texas cowboys Charles Sanders caught them interfering, was the term that they used in those days, with his wife, and he beat both of them to a pulp. Their friends, and they came back the next day, shot both of them. Wyatt, everybody knew who did it. The guy who was the trigger man actually rode through town bragging about it, and Wyatt wanted to go after him, and the sheriff said, first of all, we don't have jurisdiction beyond the city limits, and secondly, we don't want trouble with the cattle companies. And Wyatt was just appalled by that. His older brothers fought for the North in the Civil War, and they were Lincoln men. They were anti-slavery, and so I believe that the attitudes that I've portrayed in Doc are a legitimate interpretation of his real life.
Hmm. We're talking this morning in this part of Focus with Mary Doria Russell. She's a novelist. She's written four bestsellers, and her new book, which I expect will be one too, is
Seller.
Doc.
Yes, Doc is a national bestseller as of yesterday.
Already.
Yes.
And we'll talk some more with Mary in just a moment after a short break. This is Focus.
White House Chief of Staff William Daley will deliver the address at this year's commencement of the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Hear what Daley has to say, as well as other highlights from the morning campus-wide ceremony Sunday afternoon at 2 on WILL AM 580. Watch commencement on cable channel UI7 or online at illinois.edu. And join us for highlights Sunday at 2 on AM 580.
This is Focus. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here with 10 different subjects, 10 different interviews for you every week. In the second hour, we'll be having another program in the series we're calling the Trip to the Deep Archives, which celebrates 30 years on the air of this show. bringing back some programs that have not been heard in a long time. The show, the theme sort of for the show is media, and you'll be hearing some of a conversation with Newt Minow. This was from 1995. He was the head of the FCC in the Kennedy administration and the man who famously said that television was a vast wasteland. Then in the second part, a conversation from 97 with media critic Ben Bagdikian. Back in the early 80s, he was one of the first really to write about the problem of concentration of media ownership in a book that he titled The Media Monopoly. It's still in print, so you'll be hearing that hour, too. And then next week, let me just mention, we'll have the authors of three new biographies. On Monday at 10, Mary Lovell talks about a book that she's written that's a history of the Churchill family. Tuesday at 10, we will talk with Wendy Wolfe, an editor at Viking Penguin. She was the editor for a new biography of Malcolm X. Now, sadly, just before it was published, the author passed away, but we'll be talking about the book with Wendy Wolfe, who had a lot to do with it. And then next week, Wednesday at 10, Janie Scott will talk with us about her new biography of Barack Obama's mother. A Singular Woman is the title. You can find out what we're doing by going to our website. It's will.illinois.edu, and you can also catch up on some past programs that you might have missed. In this hour, the guest is Mary Doria Russell. She is award-winning author of a number of bestsellers, including The Sparrow, Children of God, A Thread of Grace, and Dreamers of the Day. She grew up in the Chicago area. In fact, her dad was the sheriff of DuPage County, Illinois. She has a doctorate in biological anthropology. She taught gross anatomy at Case Western Reserve University School of Dentistry before she started writing. And the book here is just out. And we'd be very happy to have questions, comments. People want to call in, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We've talked about how you really, what you wanted to do was try to get back to the real time and get some sense of what life really would have been like. The problem, though, is with these characters is that they're just so outsized. It's kind of hard to confine them to reality. And it is, after all, a novel. So you want to tell a good story, and the story at the center of the story is, in fact, fictional, as are some key characters. I guess I wonder how it is you thought about all of the images that we already have for these characters.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously there are multiple actors over decades of movies that have used the names of these guys. And to a certain extent, I tried to make my story congruent with the best of those. Tombstone, with Val Kilmer as Doc and Kurt Russell as Wyatt, and the Kevin Costner Wyatt Earp with Dennis Quaid as Doc Holliday, are on TV all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they dovetailed with the characters of the there's two different uses of the word character here. There are fictional characters, and then there is the character of these men that I'm describing. So when the fictional characters dovetailed with the character of the men that I was writing about, I was willing to make allusion to the best of the movies. I would occasionally throw in a small quote, just as a little wave to people who were, you know, who had seen Tombstone 150 times, all the lines. In some ways, what I had in mind, writing for Doc Holliday means going back and reading the classics. Now, Doc would have read the Aeneid in Latin. He would have read Homer in Greek. I do not have enough Latin or any Greek to be able to do that. But I read those things in translation. And looking at Virgil's Aeneid, he is doing the same sort of thing that I tried to do for this story. There is an earlier version of the fall of Troy. There is, he knows that Homer is back there and that's what people are going to be thinking as he tells his story of Aeneas. And so, but he's got another agenda. He's got a different story to tell. And so he makes it congruent with the early stories as much as possible and then explains the differences in rather graceful ways as he goes along, to tell his own story. So that's the kind of thing I said, all right, you know, if it's good enough for Virgil, by God, it's good enough for little Mary Russell.
Well, I think that you've done a really nice job evoking the period, balancing the two. I do have to say, though, I just cannot but hear the voice of Val Kilmer in my head when I'm reading
the
book.
That's deliberate because Val Kilmer got that Georgia accent down. And I'm delighted to say that the reviews from Atlanta and from the Georgia area and from people who lived in Georgia most of their lives are saying that I nailed the dialect for him. They love that Doc calls everybody sugar or darling, you know. It's Val Kilmer's voice is there, no question.
All right, let's talk. We have a caller here, someone in Atlanta, Illinois,
Illinois.
On our line 4 right here. Hello.
Good morning. Doc Holliday's always caught my imagination, and I make quite a few trips to Glenwood Springs, Colorado, where the town is more than willing to talk about Doc. And I've made a pilgrimage, so to speak, up to his grave on Boot Hill, where I found a little bottle of whiskey and some Camel cigarettes for him to get through the night.
Yes.
And I'd like to talk you to talk about, if you feel like it, about the Glenwood Springs Day. I understand from the folklore there that, as you know, he was very sick and he went there for that reason, and he continued to gamble, as you alluded to earlier.
He had no other way to make a living. He really didn't. Although he actually did continue to practice dentistry as much as he could. Now, the cough was so bad, and he was so weak towards the end that, you know, he could not do anything that was very complicated. But he would pull teeth because that was something that was very quick. And because of absolutely decades of piano practice, he had very strong hands and a great attention to technique. So he was able to help people who were in misery from toothache up until the last few months of his life.
Well, one of the folklore things there that in gambling in Glenwood Springs before he died, he did manage to kill a couple of people that were cheating. Is that true or
no? Not a chance.
Okay.
None of that happened.
People like to tell that.
Doc, my take on this is a violent time. There is no question that he killed people. He has, I believe, 3 confirmed kills. Most of the his reputation came from 2 sources. A lot of it came from Bat Masterson, who was a lying little weasel. I did not like Bat Masterson. But also, Doc had a tendency to, and Kate also had a tendency to play up his dangerousness for the same reason that a bookish small boy in high school today might come on very strong. It's to keep the big boys from stealing his lunch money. And I think that a lot of the dangerousness was something that he was willing to let his reputation do some of the fighting for him. I think that's also one of the reasons that that he was very happy to become friends with the Earps. They were big, strong guys, and nobody messed with their friend. So as far as Doc in Glenwood Springs, he was there the last 5 months of his life. He went hoping that the Sulphur Springs would help him with his health. He was very, very sick by then. And, in fact, the sulfur was even worse for his lungs, and it was also high in the mountains, so it's very thin air. So it probably actually hastened his demise. He's buried in a pauper's grave. Nobody knows where. There is a monument that was put up, I believe, in the 1990s, and he is in that cemetery someplace. But at the time, he was absolutely destitute. But people remembered him well. People said that he bore his illness with fortitude and that he was always grateful for the smallest kindness, and he always tipped well.
Well, I really appreciate the book sounds fascinating, and thank you very much.
All right,
thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, and I'm thinking about, you know, his reputation for violence and all. I'm thinking about what I think now, if I remember this right, it was Kate his mistress, who said that after the gunfight at the OK Corral, he came
wept.
Back to their room and
yes.
he wept and he said to her,
"It was
just awful." And so he, that tells you, I think that should tell you something about what the man was really like and
yeah,
perhaps
he
his
was, I mean,
reputation
this was,
for violence
was. He was not a cold, yeah. conscienceless, psychotic killer, which is the direction that the that his reputation took because of Bat Masterson. Now, you got to remember that Bat himself ended up writing a sports page column in the New York papers, and he covered boxing and horse racing. And this was also a period of time, if you remember Mark Twain, when lying was an art form. You know, they mm-hmm. called them tall tales, but basically it was lying. And people loved those things, and you were expected to exaggerate hugely. And Bat did. Like Morgan says in my book, that Bat never told a story that didn't get better over time. And so you kind of have to take anything that Bat Masterson says about anybody and divide it by five to come anywhere close to the truth. A lot of it he made up out of whole cloth. He was not above buying revolvers, putting notches into the handles, and then selling those as his own, you know, and claiming that he had killed as many men as notches he put on these things. He'd just go out, buy a new one, and then put more notches in.
Yeah. Well, now, in the book, you say that he may have been a lying little weasel, but he was game in a fight.
He was. Yeah. Yeah. And like I said, you have to remember that lying was kind of an art form. It was really something that people appreciated, yeah. And Bat was great at it.
Yeah.
But yes, he was game.
All right. Let's talk with somebody else in Belgium, Illinois. Line number one. Hello.
Hello. And early in your discussion with the author, Mr. Inge, she talked about the devotion of the mother and child between each other. And it's occurred to me that did he possibly catch what killed him from his mother?
You know, there were several people in the family who died of tuberculosis before he contracted it. It's tuberculosis is an opportunistic disease, and the bacillus is airborne, so it's easy to be. There's no question, as close as he and his mother were, that he was certainly exposed to it. But then, what makes it go active is poor living conditions, and again, that's right after the war. Margaret Mitchell talks about the great hunger that followed Sherman's march to the sea. At the time, he thought that it was because he studied too much. That was one of the theories of what caused tuberculosis, was that he was always bent over studying, and he also played piano, and he was bent as he practiced. And it was supposed to compress the chest, and that made you more vulnerable to it. But probably it was more likely stress. And a generally poorly nourished adolescence.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. I think some people have also suggested it might have been possible that he actually could have caught it from a patient.
That seems less likely to me than, you know, yes, possible, certainly. More likely, he exposed his patients to it.
Well, that's. I also think about. I would not, of all the people, I would not want to
yes.
have TB. It would be my dentist who would
exactly.
be like right
that
in
was,
my face.
That was the reason that it was so devastating. I mean, among many other reasons, but it was very devastating that he would have this. He also, the cough was so bad that he couldn't do handwork. He couldn't make dentures. It was impossible to work with gold foil fillings. So it was something that a lot of his persona in the movies is. He's so miserable that, and he knows he's going to die, so he doesn't care when, and he's, you know, just reckless.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not the man that I have portrayed, and I don't think that is the man in reality. He did everything he could to live. He did not want to die, and he certainly didn't want to die of tuberculosis, which is an absolutely wretched way to go.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that I guess at one point your working title for this book was 8-5 Against.
Yes.
And which are close odds, they're not...
close to even odds.
Close, you know, 8-5 against, that's, you know, maybe you're going to lose, but they're close. And I think that here, particularly at a certain point in the novel, I think he knows he's going to die. And there's no question about that, and he knows what's going to kill him. But he comes to the point where he says, well, I'm not going to let that define
I cannot
my
carry
life.
The fear
yeah,
any longer.
Yeah, yeah.
yeah. There has to come a time, and this is one of the things that, at my age, I've watched a lot of people die now. I've watched a lot of people get seriously ill, and it's been I've seen how different people react to it. And you do, many times, people get to a point where they say, all right, I know I'm going, and I'm not going to spend another minute of my time worrying about it. I'm going to live every second that I have left, and I'm going to do it as best I can. And that's, I believe, a moment that comes to Doc. He was a very thoughtful man.
Hmm.
And when you grow up with Stoicism and Greek philosophy, he had a lot of resources to fall back on. And at some point, I believe that he must have come to a conclusion that we are mortal, and this is probably what's going to kill me. But he did give odds of 8-5 that he would die of tuberculosis before somebody shot him again.
He seems like, clearly, the illness was something that had a way of shaping his life.
Sure.
But if you talk about his influences, in a sense, he seems like a man who was almost terminally homesick.
Yes.
And that was a really, his connection to family was so strong, understanding how he grew up, that would tell you that. And for him, it also must have been really difficult being so far away.
Exactly. And so far away from everything that he had been prepared to live with. This is a man who loves music, and he is 500 miles from the nearest symphony orchestra. At one point, he asks an Austrian character, and he says, I have heard that Brahms has released a second symphony. Is there any truth to that rumor? This is the first time that he's found somebody who will know who Brahms is. He's far away from libraries. He's far away from everything that made his life worth living. Family and music and literature and friends. All of this has been taken from him, and he's on his own in this terrible place as far as he's concerned.
Yeah. And that's, I think, what makes, in part, these characters and maybe also this time compelling is that it's such an interesting, Doc particularly, but also some of the other characters, it's such an interesting combination of roughness, rough and readiness, and sophistication, both of those things existing in this world side by side.
That was something that I became very aware of as I was writing this, was, okay, you're in the classic Western setting. You've got cow towns, you've got cattle drives, you've got the gunfights in the street and all the rest of it. At the same time that that's happening, there's Dickens and Tolstoy and Dostoevsky and, Mussorgsky is writing things. Wagner is doing the Ring cycle. All of this 19th century, the high culture, this is like the flowering of European culture. And Doc, the character Ashley Wilkes, takes his culture from Europe, as did most people who lived on the East Coast in those days. He is even farther from everything that he would have thought was important to him. I tell people, pick whatever kind of music you love best, and then think of the kind of music that just drives you nuts, that you would never want to listen to. And imagine being exiled from everything that you loved and being forced to listen to everything you can't stand. So, like, if you're a big Chopin fan and you've got to listen to, I don't know, like, death rap, it would be a difficult transition for you.
Yeah.
And that was John Henry Holliday's. That's the reality of his adult life.
And that
his entire adult life dying and in exile.
And that perhaps also explains this interesting relationship he had with Kate, not a famous beauty, but someone who, because of her background, would have been actually very similar to him and would know about a lot of the same things upbringing.
They were in many ways opposites. She was intensely pragmatic. Her father was Michael Haroni, who was the court physician to Maximilian I of Mexico. So she grew up with at an imperial court, and was multilingual just because you know, if you're Hungarian, as they were, you grow up with Magyar and with German. They were part of the Austrian Empire. They then moved to Mexico, so there was Spanish. She had Latin and Greek as a student. And then, at the age of 14, her family is caught up in the Mexican Revolution. Maximilian I is executed. The Haronis managed to get out just before people were being put up against the wall and shot. At 14, she goes from Mexico City to Davenport, Iowa. Both of her parents died within weeks of one another. The children were broken up and fostered out. And within 6 months, she had been made pregnant by her foster father. And she lived through it. And she got strong because of that. So she had like the opposite childhood in some ways. It ended sooner. She was completely without family to take her in. She made her own way and was proud of it.
Mm.
So both of them, you know, Doc thought he was taking her off the street, and she thought she was saving him from his own spendthrift aristocratic ways. It was a stormy relationship, but as Doc points out to Wyatt, our reunions are compensation for her occasional lapses in good taste.
Well,
there's going to be a lot of great makeup sex for a couple like that.
We will leave that to the imagination of the people who are listening. And we're going to have to stop. It's a great story. I enjoyed reading a lot. I think that other folks would, too. The new book here is Doc by our guest, Mary Doria Russell. It is published by Random House. She is also the author of Sparrow, Children of God, A Thread of Grace, and Dreamers of the Day. She is just about to head out and be traveling around the country.
Monday for Seattle.
And I do want to mention for people who might be listening in the Chicago area that later in June, around the middle of the month, she will be at Anderson's in Naperville on June 16th and at the Glen Ellen Book Festival on June 18th.
That's right.
Certainly if you want to read the book, you can do that. Or you can go to her website. You can find out some more about her as well. And thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
We appreciate it.
I enjoyed it.